go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win.
Welcome, everyone, to the latest episode of Deep Space High, a sci-fi TV review podcast where we break down the latest and maybe not so greatest from today's sci-fi TV. I'm Jedi Master Steven.
And I'm Sky Marshal Chris. Ooh, what you been up to, brother?
Not much. Watched the SpaceX launch that took place earlier this afternoon.
I know, me too. It's a very exciting day, huh?
Yeah, it was pretty cool to watch. First time that the United States has sent U.S. astronauts on a U.S. rocket from U.S. soil since 2011. And it's also the first time that a private company, or any company for that matter, has sent astronauts into space. From before today, it was all national governments and government agencies that were sending them.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's a very exciting day. I'm looking forward to what Elon Musk and SpaceX is going to be doing here in the future. I know President Trump announced that they're going to be sending manned missions to the moon, and they're also going to be sending manned missions to Mars too. So, I mean, it's very exciting times if you are a sci-fi fan and you love space travel.
Yeah, and I think their goal is to hit the moon in the next, I think it's 4 years at least. And I know, you know, Musk is working on all kinds of projects. I was looking at their launch schedule, and they have like half a dozen launches between now and September, because they're launching satellites up for his Starlink project. They're launching, I think, cargo to the space station. On August 30th, they're doing another manned rocket launch on the Falcon 9. Instead of a two-man crew, this will be the four-man crew. Actually, it's, yeah, three guys and a girl, whatever.
And, you know, it's amazing. President Trump was talking about how the NASA scientists told him that the calculations were down to the very second, that they had it timed out to the exact second that they wanted to launch. And I think that that is incredible when you think about how precise the mathematics have to be, that if you're off by 1 second, everything could be, the whole mission could be thrown off. I mean, it's truly remarkable the amount of detail that they go into this stuff.
Well, yeah, and a lot of it's, you know, the ship can essentially fly itself for the most part to the space station, and then I think it could even dock itself to the space station. So there's a lot of computer technology that Musk has in that company and in his starships and his computers.
Yeah, it was a big win today for Musk.
Yeah, I'm sure he was stoked.
Well, Steve, are you ready to get started with this episode?
You can do it! You can do it all night long!
Yeah, sure. Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Okay, man, let's do it.
I mean, come on, I just don't see a problem here. Let's just do it.
I'm gonna go do it.
All right, well, Steve, what are we going over today?
Today's episode, we are going over Star Trek Picard Season 1, Episode 8, entitled Broken Pieces. And this episode, it starts with another flashback, not surprisingly, since, what do we say, six of eight episodes have started with a flashback so far, and then the other two were dreams.
Yep. And so with this one, or no, for next one, we need to keep an eye out and see if they do another flashback, because if they do, that would be 7 out of 9 times.
Yeah, and we've all seen, I get it. I know we've both seen them, but I don't remember how the next episode starts.
Well, we're going to rewatch them again anyway, so we'll find out next week.
Yeah, we'll find out, and we'll see if we have a pun to make. But with this opening scene, we start 14 years in the past, and it's a weird scene where you kind of see a bunch of Romulan ladies in a circle. You see Commodore O, and she kind of does a group mind meld to these ladies, and they all see the destruction that the synthetics are going to have on the world if they are allowed to roam free. So after the mind meld, if it can even be a mind meld, it was like a, I don't know how to explain it. They were holding on to, or they were all in a little circle, and it was like a ring around the rosy meld. And and then they losing their shit.
I think what it was, like, yeah, if you notice, when they start losing their shit, you see, like, all the flashbacks of, like, what's happened in the past. I think in the previous episode, it's the same stuff that Commodore O shows Dr. Girardi. So this is where they got that information from. And you also see an android, and you see Data in these flashbacks. So I thought that was kind of interesting on why they kind of threw him in there. Maybe it has to do, you know, we find out that it might have something to do with synthetic life forms, since, you know, it's Commodore O. This is what they showed, or this is how they all see these things. And then we also find out that we see Rizzo, and we also see a lady that we see in a previous episode that went crazy on Soji at the Borg Cube, who turns out to be Rizzo's aunt.
Yeah.
But do you notice who wasn't there? Like, in that whole group of people or women who were standing around, you notice who was missing?
Narek?
Yep. So why is it only women who are there seeing these things? Especially when Narek's the one getting involved, trying to, you know, he's involved. He's knee-deep in this, too. He's trying to figure all this shit out, too, and help him out, but yet Narek's not there. So we're going to figure all this shit out.
That's a good point, because it seemed like the way they explained the Jot Vosh in this scene, it was an all-female group of the Tal Shiar.
I mean...
So I don't know.
It would make sense. Like, because who was the group that Elnor was a part of? What was the name? Do you remember the name of that group?
The Kuat Min La?
Yeah, they were all female, too. Yeah. And they were the arch-enemies of, you know, the Tal Shiar. Or at least that's what they said. So maybe the Tal Shiar and the... What was it called again? I don't even think I could pronounce it.
Kuat Min La.
Yeah, they're all female-based organizations. Maybe Romulans are more female-based or female-centric, which would be weird, speaking how most of the Romulans that we encounter are men.
After that scene, it jumps back to the present day, where you see Rizzo and her aunt kind of talking, and you get a little bit of information that the Borg Cube decided to assimilate the wrong Tal Shiar ship.
Well, the way that I think they explained it was they weren't really talking. Like, the aunt was kind of like in a coma, and Rizzo was just kind of talking to her while she was in coma, because remember, the aunt was there, and everybody went fucking crazy when they saw what happened, except for Rizzo. You know, they're all bashing in their heads, they're pulling their phasers out, blowing out their brains. You know, like, they went crazy over this shit. And then apparently the Borg Cube, we actually find out what happened with this Borg Cube in this scene. We figured out how the Borg Cube became destroyed, how it became an artifact. And it was actually the auntie, who was a member of the Tal Shiar, who just went fucking patriot, just one man army, and just like destroyed the Borg Cube, just one Tal Shiar ship. I'm like, talk about fucking with the wrong shit. Especially if they did all that by themselves. That's
did they impressive. Is that how they described it? I must have missed that, because I didn't catch that when I was watching it. Even I mean, I've watched this a couple times, and it's not what I got from it, so I'll have to go back and rewatch that opening scene. And
I think I've watched it 3 or 4 times, and that's kind of how they make it seem, like that the aunt was commanding the ship, the Tal Shiar ship that they were on, and she just fucking balled out and nearly took it single-handedly until they eventually assimilated her and assimilated the ship. But the ship was so far gone, and then I think, now this part's just my theory, I think when they assimilated her, they got the information from what she saw, and that's what shut down the entire cube, and that's why they isolated the cube. That's just my theory.
Yeah, I'll have to go back and rewatch that scene and see if I can catch that with that mindset now, because I didn't grab it the first couple times I saw it, so.
Then when you lost your mind, you certainly did it with panache. Breaking a Borg cube by the sheer force of your despair. The Collective picked the wrong Tal Shiar ship to assimilate that day.
But, yeah, right before we go... Moving on a little bit, right before we get into the introduction, you get a brief scene with Elnor is trying to do what he can and fight off some other Romulans when it seems like he's about to meet his match, and before 7 of 9 comes in and just starts blasting people like the Lone Ranger.
Yeah, I know, right? Like John Wayne just going left, right, knocking down everybody he sees. Like, goddamn. And then I love how Seven, she just starts asking like a whole bunch of questions, like, where's Hugh? What's going on? What the hell is happening? And the first thing Elnor does is he runs and gives her a hug. I'm like, I don't blame you.
Yep. And then cue introduction.
But they like to wait to do those intros, don't they? They're almost like George Lopez, wait 10 minutes before they actually do the introduction.
Yeah, you get a couple scenes. It seems to be you get the flashback, and sometimes after the flashback, it's into the intro, or you'll get a quick scene or two of present day scenes, and then they'll cut into the introduction into the episode.
Yeah.
After this introduction into the episode, it seems like we have a couple storylines. We have a storyline A, a B, and a C. And A and B kind of intertwine, which is we'll say A is the Picard storyline. And then B is the Rafi Rio storyline.
Yeah, and then C would be the Borg Cube then.
Yeah, and I think B, even though we're calling it B storyline for the purposes of this podcast, I really think it's more of the main storyline. Because it feels like you get more information through this storyline than anywhere else, at least in my opinion.
Well, I feel like I think we're starting to get to the episode where the storylines are starting to merge together and interconnect. So we kind of were going through a couple episodes of just kind of separate different storylines. That's kind of what we got to last episode. And now we're starting to see the culmination of the different storylines come together in this episode. So I think that's kind of why it's so confusing.
Yeah, because A and B no doubtingly, you know, they intertwine together. But the first scene that we get after this introduction is over is you see Picard and Soji return from an Nepethine visiting the Rikers, and Rios is just like, he's spacing out. He's tripping. Like, he's looking at Soji.
I've had those days.
State of shock. But he's looking. Yeah, we've all had them. Yeah.
There is like, what the fuck is going on here? I mean, yeah, he just he just completely spaces out. Like, just freaks out when he sees Soji. Oh. Well, I guess not freaked out, but just like is just state of pure shock. Like, he did not expect it to be her.
Yeah, and Picard was sitting there trying to talk to him. He's like, hey, we got to get to Deep Space 12. Come on. And it took him a minute or two to snap out of it and lay in a course. And as soon as he lays in a course, he bolts back to his cabin.
Yeah, another thing that I thought was weird was like Rafi was just kind of casually walking by like, minding my own business. And then she just out of nowhere kind of sees that he's kind of completely zoned out and he's freaking out and like, okay, what's going on here? And then once she sees Picard and Soji and Rios, you know, kind of gets her shit together, she starts grilling Picard and Soji.
Yeah, she pulls a freaking phaser on him.
Yeah, and then I kind of find it weird how she just kind of goes from casual, like, to pulling out a phaser on Soji.
She's like, stick him up, bro. Stick him up, bro. Don't you go anywhere, you motherfucker. And then she starts grilling Picard about bringing a possible traitor on board, which, I mean, I could see her skepticism and her paranoia after what just happened with Girardi in the previous episode, but still felt a little out of line.
A little bit, but, I mean, this whole situation that they're going through is confusing, and just to find out that everything that they're doing is kind of interconnected, I mean, I'd be freaking out too.
I was going to say, after they kind of dissolve that situation, unless you have another point to bring on.
No, I was going to transition. I was going to say, and that's kind of where we see the separation of the storylines. You know, that's when we see that these storylines in this episode start to break apart a little bit. And then,
Yeah. Cause you know, here's where storyline A, Picard goes back into his quarters, which is a hologram of his study from Earth. and he contacts Starfleet, and he's having a conversation with Admiral Clancy, trying to request a squadron of Starfleet ships, which, I mean, in my minimal experience with Star Trek, I never heard it referred to anything other than a fleet. But yeah, he's requesting that a squadron meet them at Deep Space 12 as reinforcements before they go and get Soji to her homeworld.
You notice squadron more when you get to Deep Space 9, because that's when you start seeing hundreds of thousands of starships in Deep Space 9 for battle and war. But you haven't gotten far enough yet. You're still on what, like season 3 of Deep Space 9?
Oh no, I've put it on the back burners for right now. I've just been watching whatever.
So yeah, you do notice Squadron more in Deep Space 9, but I just love how this is the same Admiral that we were talking to, or Picard was talking to in the very beginning of the series, trying to get help, trying to get just one ship. And basically she told them to fuck off. And I like it because she kind of does the same thing again in this one. Well, you know, he's begging for, or well, not really begging, but he's giving his famous Picard speech on why the Federation needs to help. And I just love how she's like, God damn it, Picard, for once in your life, shut the fuck up. I'm already agreeing to help you. We don't need the speech. And yeah. I'm just like, oh, I love it. That was probably one of my favorite scenes so far in the entire series. Just because somebody put Picard in her place. And you'll never see that in the Next Generation, like ever.
Not really.
Mostly because they can't swear. But.
Yeah, and then, you know, this episode does a lot of scene jumping, so we'll jump to storyline C real quick, which is, you know, they're back on the cube. You get a shot of Rizzo, and Rizzo finds like a button or a little badge where it's one of those Ferris Ranger badges, if I'm saying that right. But it's the badge that 709 has, and she's like, oh shit, now I know 709's on this ship, time to go knock some people around and try to find her.
Yeah, that was the badge that she gave Picard when she said, hey, if you ever need help, push it and I'll be there to help. Yeah. I think that's what she finds. So
yeah, and I think Elnor had it, so he called her for help.
Yeah, I mean, he needed it, and she came to the rescue just in time.
Yeah, but you get that scene where she finds out Seven's on the cube, and then Rizzo's like, well, they hatch a plan to kind of open one of the hatches, essentially, and kind of depressurize the cube and have all the XBs blown off of the ship into space.
Yeah, which is pretty fucked up and cold-hearted.
Yeah, but she's been fucked up and cold-hearted this whole season, so I wouldn't really expect anything less from her. But it was just kind of, it was a really quick scene. It was like 45 to 60 seconds of a scene.
Yeah, I mean, it was really short, but you did get one interesting piece of, not really information, but just something that most Star Trek fans would have noticed, and that's how the Borg cubes regenerated. Because if you notice, when they were regenerating the Borg cube, it was almost like a bunch of little cockroaches on the outside of the ship repairing the ship. That's new. They've never done that in Star Trek before. So that's a whole new concept that the show is doing. Well, no, that was the same scene where they find out, and then they talk about how they start making plans to blow out the XBs. That was in the same scene.
I must have missed that.
Yeah, because I even wrote it in my notes.
I didn't miss it. I just thought it was later in the episode.
No. Okay. No, it was in that scene. I know, because I have it on right now, and that's what we're talking about. And so.
Okay.
But I just thought that was interesting, because like how they explained it in The Next Generation was, actually, they really didn't explain it. They just said that they're regenerating, that it's regenerating themselves, and how they showed it in season two, I think, that's when they first met the Borg. How they showed it was, it's just healing itself, almost like the metal is just reforming and reshaping to take the position. Where here now, it's almost like a bunch of cockroaches, little workers on the outside of cube putting everything back together, which would make a little bit more sense, but I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was cool to see. Let's jump back to what's happening on Rios' ship. I can never think of his ship's name, but we get a scene where Picard and Soji are having lunch on, I don't know if you noticed, the picnic tables they were eating on, we had them when I was in high school, and they would be around our quad, and
they still have them.
Okay, so they're essentially 400-year-old picnic benches sitting in this 24th century ship. You couldn't design something a little better. They're like, no, let's go to the local high school, pick up some of their lunch tables that they have for outside, and let's just use that for the cafeteria area of the ship. It's like, man, let's save us some money. Let's just borrow some shit.
Yeah, we've gone into all this detail for every other possible scene, but let's just get the cheapest and simplest benches we can possible.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Let's do that. That makes total sense to have those type of tables on this ship.
I hated those tables, by the way, too, because we had the exact same thing in high school. I mean, you and I went to different high schools, too.
I didn't like seeing them on the show because it was like, it took me out of the show because the show is supposed to be sci-fi. It's supposed to be in the future. But I'm seeing the high school tables that I sat at every day for 3 years while I was at that school. Fantastic.
I don't know. It's one of those things to where it could still be around. Like, maybe those designs don't really need to change over the time. Like, it's supposed to be 400 years in the future. Like, is there nothing from hundreds of years ago that we don't still use today? Paper? We still use paper. Paper's still the same.
Yeah, but even that's evolved over. Even that's evolved.
It's evolved a little bit. I'm sure that's like a tritanium alloy picnic table. I'm sure it's the same thing, just a similar design.
My point is, why are you going to stick with a design like that for so many years when you could probably design just a lighter weight and different table? I don't know. It just reminded me of high school, and I did not like seeing those tables on this show for a sci-fi show.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I hated those tables in high school, too. They were awful tables.
So what happens in this scene is Soji and Picard have conversations about Data. Soji wants to know more about Data, so he's telling her that Data was always striving to be more human. He always made us laugh, except for when he was trying to make us laugh. And he, yeah.
Oh, poor guy.
And then
I know how he feels.
So he gives him a brief history. gives him or gives.
You're trying not to laugh because you know it's true.
Yeah, I'm trying not to because I'm trying to get through this.
Because
essentially, Picard just gives her a brief rundown of who, you know, if anyone that has seen TNG or at least the last couple episodes of the series, we kind of have a very good idea of who Data is. So it's kind of repetitive to repeat of who Data is and what he stood for and why they were such good friends for, you know. But they decided to pound that down our throats one more time. The only thing that caught my attention from this scene was Picard was like, he says something about Data having limited abilities in expressing emotion. And he was like, sounds just like me. And I was like, what the fuck? You've been an emotional little bitch this whole episode or this whole series.
That's true. But he was not emotional in The Next Generation. Like, there was no emotions whatsoever. Like, he was almost made of iron. Like,
yeah. But there was times where he was very, like, passionate about things. And he, you know, he did give off emotion. He was probably as close to Vulcan as any human could be emotion-wise in TNG. But you still saw in the movies where he got pretty emotional, where he would get very angry. And, you know, when his emotions hit in the show or in the movies, you know, they hit him hard.
Yeah, they did, but that was mostly anger, you know, that's been built up over a period of years of what the Borg did to him, and he wants to draw the line. You know, I know what scene, I know what movie you're talking about. You're talking about First Contact, especially since it's a very famous soundbite of when he's yelling no and then smashes all of his little ships. But he's had built up anger about what the Borg did to him for a long time. And then that's kind of one of the things that bothered me about this show too. Like, Picard hates the Borg, but he's always been rational and clear thought or clear headed when it comes to what he needs to do to stop the Borg. You know, he knew exactly how to destroy the Borg in First Contact, but in Picard, you know, he's almost like a crying little baby when he encounters the Borg. Like, he's almost just straight up terrified. And I know he is scared of the Borg. He didn't like what they did to him, but I figured it'd still be more anger rather than fear, especially when he conquered that at the end of the movie. He overcame his hate in the movie. So, I mean, it's one of those things to where the directors, I like to say they're not true Star Trek fans, but they've seen it and they're trying to do stuff, but they don't understand the concept of the principles behind the show. They're not true. It's like, it's almost like Star Wars, how Star Wars, the new Star Wars movies, it's like, yeah, they watch the show, they get it, but they don't truly understand the, what it means for it to be a Star Wars film. And it's kind of that same for me.
Yeah. I wouldn't say directors. I would say the producers and writers.
Yeah. I would actually agree with that. I think the directors have actually done a pretty good job, or they've done a pretty decent job.
Yeah. Cause the directors just work with the script and work with the producers to, you know, put out an episode that everyone, or they put out an episode that reflects the script as much as possible. So you know, I wouldn't put much of it on them unless they are making those decisions and those departures, which I don't think they are, especially since Frakes directed two or three of these episodes.
I thought the Frakes episodes were actually pretty good that he directed.
Yeah, they were. But let's get back onto this episode.
Yes.
We're going to talk about storyline B for a little bit, which is the Raffi and Rios type storyline where Raffi's trying to piece everything together.
I think that next scene would be where they talk to the EEH, Emergency Engineering Hologram?
Yeah, I think it's actually...
Or am I skipping ahead? I think I'm skipping.
No, I don't. We'll just kind of discuss, because I don't remember where the scenes fall in the episode specifically, but, you know, we'll kind of lump all, when she's talking with all the emergency holograms as a scene or two. Because, so she talks with the emergency navigational hologram and asks him to run a... like a facial recognition and see if he can get any pings, and he pings her as a Jenna, and then she was like, well, who's this Jenna? And he was like, oh, I can't, there, I have no information on that.
Right, he thought Soju was Jenna.
Yeah. And then she asked him navigational questions, because I guess at some point Raffi discovered a 8-star system, or an 8-play, or yeah.
Well, no, she said that it was when she was on the Borg cube, they were drawing these symbols, the pictures of the system, and she asked the navigation if it looked familiar.
This caught my eye while I was surveilling the cube. All these Romulans sitting around drawing this over and over. 8 circles, see?
And he said that it looks like an octonary star system, which is a star system made up of 8 stars.
Looks like an attempt to depict an octonary.
A what now?
A planetary system with 8 component stars.
In the conversation, they were talking about this octuary or whatever star system. And the navigation person said it's pretty much impossible, but there are some records in ancient Romulan star maps that have it, but they're not in the modern Romulan star maps.
This is New Scorpion. A septenary system, which are extremely rare, but an octonary. There are accounts of one in some ancient Romulan star atlases, but they're considered apocryphal. They don't appear in any of their modern charts.
They say that the only ones that they've noticed were septenary, which is 7 star systems, but not an octonary.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I noticed that I thought was kind of interesting was Raffi points out that she thought the Conclave of 8 meant it was like a group of 8 people who were the ones who were responsible for destroying Mars. And then when the ENH talks about the octonary star systems, the idea with 8 stars, she starts thinking of, wait a minute, maybe it's the Conclave of 8 is not a group of people, but it's supposed to be the symbol of the star system. And she starts trying to figure out some more information on this stuff. And it's something that I didn't notice when watching it, actually the first couple times, until Raffi brought up the Conclave of 8.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's something you noticed or not.
No, I don't. I'll be honest, I didn't really remember this episode much until we rewatched it to do this podcast on it.
Yeah, I know. I even had to rewatch it twice just because I missed a lot of stuff. And there's a lot more information in this episode than I think we're even picking up.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. There's so much. This is the episode where everything essentially gets pieced together, and you know, they're taking all previous 7 episodes and even some things from past Trek and kind of divulging and revealing everything that's kind of going on in this episode. So there's a lot in this that we're missing and probably won't get to cover, one either because we didn't pick it up when we watched it, or we just didn't see it as something we needed to talk about in this podcast.
See, now, is that just poor writing then? Like, is that on the writers of, you know, I get it, you're trying to piece everything together, but you're trying to throw so much when you're already 8 episodes into your 10-episode season, and you're just now piecing all this together, you're piecing all the storylines together, and you're throwing all this information and all this stuff in one episode. You know, do you think that's kind of on the writers of, hey, you didn't really do a good job at you know, fitting this along through the rest of the season? You stretched it out more than you needed to, and then you just throw everything in one episode.
Yeah, could be. Could very well be. And it's one of those things. It's just, I don't know.
All right. Well, then let's move on with this storyline then, B storyline.
Yeah, let's keep talking about this storyline for a little bit, because after she talks to the navigation, she goes and talks to the engineering hologram, and it pretty much confirms the data that the navigational one was saying, that it's extremely unlikely that it's natural that a Octa star system, is what I'm going to call it, the Octa star system exists. It's extremely unlikely. And she was like, well, then she kind of comes to the realization that there's a pretty good chance that the Romulans at some point captured 7 other suns, brought it to this one star system, and then man-made a Octa star system, which is a very interesting thing, because how the hell would one go about capturing 7 stars, transporting them light years away from where they were, and then just throwing them into a single star system, and then, I guess, setting them in some sort of orbit? Or
I actually don't think it'd be that hard. It's already been done. They pretty much done it before in the shows. I mean, you gotta think of, in Next Generation, they had the Dyson Sphere, which basically was a giant metal dome built with the same circumference as an astronomical unit around this star. So basically it's just one giant metal dome that's the same orbit as the Earth is from the star. And there was engineers capable of building that. You know, they were capable of moving giant or small moons with their transport, or not their transporters, their tractor beams, by changing, basically creating a subspace warp bubble around the moon to eliminate the weight of the moon to be able to push it. So I'd imagine it'd be a similar concept with the stars, just on a much grander scale, like probably something a million times more powerful than your tractor beam, and you just create that subspace bubble around it to basically make it lighter so you can push it. That's how I would imagine. But still, I mean, in the universe, it's easily explained in the Star Trek universe, but in reality, that's fucking good luck with that.
Yeah, and that's the point I was trying to make. It just seems far-fetched to think that, because I remember the Dyson Sphere episode that you were talking about, and in that episode, all they did was pretty much built a barrier around the sun so they could capture or harness its energy and not let anything go to waste.
Right.
If I remember that episode right. So, but to take that and
I think the better question would be why? Why would anybody even want to make an octonary system? Maybe just like to show off? Like, what would be the purpose of creating that octonary system?
Well, I think she goes into that and she says that they created it and then it ended up turning into a warning because of what happened when the Romulans developed AI and synthetics hundreds of thousands of years ago, that it ended up destroying a good portion of the universe. So then they built and kind of grabbed these stars, threw them together as a warning of their past mistakes.
Well, here's something interesting. When Rafi is not drunk, she's actually pretty good at investigating shit. Like, she's pretty good at getting, piecing all this stuff together.
Yeah, she had a pretty high ranking in Starfleet before all this shit happened. And, you kind of assumed she's a pretty intelligent woman, but addiction has kind of been her downfall.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. Alcohol has brought down a lot of great people in history, so.
So that and whatever snake venom or whatever that smoking drug is that she was doing in previous episodes. So it might just be one of those things where she's smart, but addiction got to her.
But I guess it's not just her that it's getting, because apparently Rios is knocking down a couple bottles too. So when Rios set the course for Deep Space 12, he pretty much just went into his room and got fucked up drunk and started recollecting some old memories.
Yeah, I think he has some drinking problems too. I don't think they're to the extent of Raffi's, but he opened up his chest of all his memories, and you know, in there was a suitcase from the old ship he used to work on, the USS Ibn Majad, or Ibn Majid, whatever it was called. Which, surprisingly enough, I was able to get the NCC number on that, so hey.
Oh, nice. What was the NCC number?
76710. NCC-76710. I actually paused it so I could make note of that.
All right, well, let's see how good you are. What's my favorite cigar?
The Romeo and Juliet, or Romeo e Juliet, which is, he has a case of those in his suitcase, or in his memory chest, or whatever it is.
Yes, he has very good taste in cigars, especially since he has a whole box of my favorite cigars.
Well, not really. Did you notice there was only one cigar in there and a bunch of photos and other kind of things from his Starfleet days? So he's already smoked most of it.
Yeah, and we saw that. Like, he's been smoking cigars pretty much the entire series.
Oh, yeah. Then, you know, it's nice to know that he's smoking Romeo e Juliet's.
Yeah, it's nice to know that they'll still be around in 400 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was the Reserva Real is what the name of the cigar was.
Oh, was it?
But yeah, I think so. And I've had a few of those, so they're pretty good cigars.
Yeah. Yeah, they are.
I enjoy them, at least. Let's jump to storyline C. Let's get back to the cube. Seven is explaining to Elnor that she wants to reactivate some of the XBs and like reassimilate them and activate all the ones they haven't de-assimilated yet and go and use them to fight off the Romulans on the cube. But she's concerned because she doesn't want to subject them to that. And Elnor brings up a very great point where he's like, well, this is only temporary. You'll release them after, you know, we're done doing what we need to do to save them. And then you kind of get the haunting feeling. Well, she says it, but you get the haunting feeling where she's like, she doesn't want to really relinquish control of them.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of where you miss a lot from not watching Voyager with this aspect. Because in Voyager, she's constantly, like, Seven of Nine is struggling with her individuality. She did not want individuality. She wanted to stay part of the Borg. Like, her name was Annika Hansen. She was one of the first humans ever assimilated by the Borg. And she was assimilated when she was, like, 6 years old. So she grew up with the Borg. And she spent, like, the first, you know, 18 years of her life with the Borg. So she was like 24 when Voyager gave her that sense of individuality, and she didn't want it. And she tried over and over and over again to go back to the Borg. So for her to reassimilate with the Borg collective, to take away their sense of individuality, you know, to her, that's almost like she's a drug addict and she's going back to her drug, which in this case would be the Borg. Hmm. So, she's afraid of, if I do it, I might not want to give it up. And she's genuinely afraid of it, which I understand.
Yeah, that makes sense where, you know, someone who hasn't seen Voyager, i.e. me or other Star Trek fans, they might not have picked up on the seriousness of that conversation then, because I definitely didn't. It just felt like something that it should have been fairly easy for her to just let go and move on, which eventually, you know, she does reactivate the Borg and she does go to fight them. But, you know, Rizzo's already one step ahead and opens up all those doors and shoots all the Borgs out.
Yeah. And then you even notice it when she says Annika is not done yet, because Annika was her original name. Like, Annika's not done yet. She's still got work to do.
Yeah, I caught that and I thought that's what that was, because I did see the first couple episodes of Voyager where Seven of Nine was introduced, so I caught that. I don't think many people will who haven't seen Voyager.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's why I wanted to make sure that I brought that up. Because even when watching that scene, I'm like, I know Steve's not gonna notice that, or he's not gonna pick up the nuance behind that. So I even specifically wrote that down for that explanation.
Yeah, and when I heard it, I was like, Annika, and I had to really think about it. And it wasn't a direct link, but I was like, maybe that was her name before she was assimilated. And then I kind of just brushed over it and moved on with the episode. It was just, I think that's what that was, but I couldn't confirm it. But since you did now, it's confirmed.
It is confirmed.
Cool beans.
So yeah, that's pretty much what happens in that scene. These cube scenes are not very long either. Like, they're kind of short, almost 1-2 minute scenes.
Yeah, they're all very short, and you know, it's like we're calling it storyline C, but it's really like it's just a mini storyline. A and B is really dominating this episode with what's happening on the La Serena. Rios' ship just hit me.
Nice.
Because there you get a lot of information. Jumping back to the ship, obviously, you have Rafi ends up getting all of the emergency holograms for La Serena together in a room and trying to piece everything together. They bring up Jana again, try to figure out who she is. Then one of them notes something with Captain Alonzo Vandermeer, who was Rios' captain on the starship piece of the Ibn Majid. You get a lot of information about that, but it's broken information, because you find out one of them knows that captain killed themselves and that something happened on that ship, and whatever happened and took place on that ship caused Rios to lose his, you know, lose it a little bit, and then Starfleet ended up giving him the boot within 6 months of that incident happening.
Have you noticed that these holograms are kind of weird?
Yeah, and I wanted to give props to the actor, because they're all very unique for being the same guy.
Yeah, it's like same guy, different personalities.
Like, yeah, because what you have a Scottish one, you have the hospitality hologram, which is kind of English-esque.
And he's very, like, he's weird. Like, he kept getting into everybody's space, like personal space, like get real close. Like, really, dude? Like, that's kind of... And then, of course, the Scottish one's the engineer.
Yeah, of course, it has to be. I was going to say, Rios is kind of... Well, that actor has kind of been one of my favorite... The highlights of this season for me, because of, you know, him playing Rios and then him playing the five different holograms. I mean, that can't be an easy task, especially since the holograms each have a different type of personality.
Oh, yeah, same. And I think the acting altogether has been phenomenal. Like, Rios is doing that too, but you also have to understand the actress who plays Sochi is doing the same thing. She's playing multiple different characters in a very difficult roles, and she's doing a very good job of it. So yeah. hints to the casting director for getting some really good actors.
Yeah, because they've been the highlight of this season for me. And back to that scene where they're all together, you kind of get, you know, they're able to give her enough information to where Rafi has a general idea of what might have happened, but she still doesn't know. And they even suggest, they're like, you got to go talk to Rios. He's the only person on this ship that knows. So that's the only way she's going to find out. So after Rafi's done talking with the holograms, and they suggest that she goes talk to Rios, and Rios tells her to piss off, you get a nice, not, I won't say nice scene, but you get a scene with, in storyline A, with Picard and Girardi, where Girardi comes out of her coma.
Yeah, I almost forgot about the Picard storyline. They don't really do much in that one.
No, like I said, we call it the A, but I think B's really the main storyline in this episode.
I think you might be right. But yeah, I mean, she finally woke up, and then Picard confronted her on whether or not, or, well, I don't want to say confronted, but just basically said, hey, you know you're going to need to turn yourself in for Bruce Maddox, or the murder of Bruce Maddox. She's like, yeah, I know. And then trying to figure out why did it, you know, whether the poison that she injected in herself, whether it actually worked to disable the tracking device.
Well, yeah, that was the first thing she asked. She was like, did it work? And he's like, you mean the whatever you injected in yourself to turn off the tractor or deactivate the tractor? He was like, yeah. She was like, oh, okay. And then that's when he's like, well, you got to turn yourself in for the murder of Maddox.
Now, here's what I'm curious about. Did she try to kill herself, or was she just trying to take out the tracker? Because remember, all the Vulcan, or not the Vulcan, the Romulan bitches in the beginning of the episode that saw this, they all blew their brains out and tried to kill themselves. So was this her trying to kill herself, or was this her trying to just disable the tracker?
I don't know. That's a tough one, because in the scene, you kind of find out, ever since what happened with O, she does kind of have that urge to commit suicide. But not really sure if the attempt was to just deactivate the tractor, if that was a part of her plan, or if she initially thought that if she kills herself, that's the end of that. They can't track them, and then she won't have to deal with it anymore. I don't know. I'm not really sure. It could go either way.
Yeah, it could. Time will tell.
Yeah, but what really got my attention from this scene is Girardi's talking about her conversation with O to Picard, and you find out that during this mind meld that she put a psychic blocker on so that she couldn't talk about what she saw. And I didn't know that was a possibility with Vulcans to do that. They had that type of control. I thought it was just my mind to your mind, your thought, my thoughts to your thoughts, or whatever they say whenever they do the mind meld. I didn't think they actually had the ability to put a psychic blocker and kind of make it so they can't talk about these events that they shared with them.
They can, actually. So again, you Voyager. Long story short, Voyager. You missed a lot with Voyager. So Voyager has a Vulcan on it called Tuvok. He is the chief of security. They also have another Vulcan that they use as like a sub-storyline. He is an engineer, tries to bang the chief engineer. Yeah, that's an interesting story. But they go a lot into mind melds, Vulcan meditation. They get very deep in a lot of explanations in Star Trek Voyager that they don't do in The Next Generation, and they really don't do in the original series. Because in the original series, they talk about a lot of stuff and general concepts, but they get a lot more in-depth in it with Voyager and Enterprise, because Enterprise was basically just all Vulcans. So, you know, again, it's more of just kind of missing out a lot. But yeah, they can do that. They can. There's more to mind melds than what we have perceived from The Next Generation and the original series. There's a lot more to it.
Yeah, that was just one of my things, since I never saw, or I haven't seen that many episodes of Voyager, obviously. To those other Star Trek and casual Star Trek fans who are in the same boat as I guess there's a good little explanation.
Yeah, it's almost like the Star Trek version of, these are not the droids you're looking for.
Yeah, the Jedi mind trick.
But instead of the hand wave, they put their hands on their head.
Yep, okay. Well, that's news to me, so. And I'm sure it's news to a lot of people.
Yeah, well, you learn something new every day. This is why you have a Trekkie on the show, to explain things.
Yeah, but later in the same scene, you Soji and Girardi meet for the first time. And Girardi is just obviously, you know, given her profession, she is just baffled by what she's seeing. And she's just asking her what, in my mind, is a bunch of dumb questions. She's like, how do you feel when you're hungry? Or what do you do? And then Soji's like, I eat. And she asks the same thing about when she's thirsty and when she's tired. She's like, I sleep. I drink something. When I'm horny, I fuck, you know. I mean, there's a Romulan on the cube who will explain this all.
Now, if it was us, we would have asked about the vibrating vagina.
Yeah.
That would have been the perfect opportunity to ask.
Yeah, there you go. Opportunity missed. Thanks, Girardi. Screwing it up for everybody.
You know, I mean, a lot of people are probably thinking it's kind of pointless, but it's not the first time that they have attacked that perspective. Because in the original series, Dr. Bashir, who is the doctor on Deep Space Nine, he asked the same questions about Data. You know, he's amazed by the little aspects and details of how close that Dr. Soong tried to make these androids appear human. You know, all the little details, nuances. You can breathe, you can grow hair, you can grow, you know, you have pores, you have skin. You know, Data's often fond of saying, if you prick me, do I not leak? You know, a lot of these aspects of it might seem simple, but it's important to that storyline.
Yeah, and like I remember we talked about this in a previous episode of this show, and it's just one of those, you know, watching it, they seem like silly questions. But if you're actually in those shoes, they are important questions, because you're looking at a human, or not human, but a man-made created object that appears human.
Right. It's the closest that man can come to recreating man.
Yeah, and I guess an engineer or a scientist would ask those what seem like silly questions to an android.
Right, but she's also the, you know, the foremost experts on cybernetics on Earth. So, you know, those little details are important because those are the little details that make up our humanity.
We'll touch on one more or touch on one more part of that scene before we move on to the next one, where Soji's kind of afraid Girardi's going to end her because Soji knows. She's like, didn't O tell you to kill me as soon as you saw me? And Girardi's like, well, now that I've seen you, there's no way in hell I'm going to kill you.
Right.
Which it was a nice, important little scene to get because otherwise you would have had Soji looking over her shoulder, which she still might be. And, that was part of Girardi's task was to end her when she found her.
Yeah. And then you also find out about something called the Seb Chneb, which means the destroyer. And this is where you start getting that storyline of Soji is the destroyer, which is also what the crazy aunt at the beginning of this episode that we saw again from a previous episode yelled at her that she was the destroyer.
Yeah, and you know, this is not the first or even the second time we've heard her called the destroyer in this series or her sister. Mm-hmm. So it's just more of we get a lot of information, a lot of it new, but a good portion of it is not new. And we really don't need to get, you know, we don't need a redumping of this information.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. It just, like I said, you know, what we talked about earlier in the episode, this is more of they're trying to piece all the pieces that they've been building up to in the previous episodes and put it all together in this one episode.
Yep, let's wrap up on this cube storyline. You get a lot. I mean, again, it's two short scenes, so Rizzo starts murdering these XBs and just cold-bloodedly is just walking around with a phaser, you know, popping caps and everyone like they're, I don't know. But she just starts murdering them all and getting rid of them because she knows there's going to be some type of plot where they're going to try to be turned against her. I mean, we already talked about Seven activating the Borgs.
Well, I mean, this is when they actually launched all the Borgs into space. They just in case for those of you, you know, most people don't know, there's about 50,000 Borg drones per cube. So yeah. just to get that idea of how many Borg were launched into space when Rizzo activated them. And then the next scene was when Rizzo was actually being attacked by the remaining XBs that 709 had taken control of. And again, the bitch seems to be able to get away via transport at the luckiest times because she's getting attacked by like 10 or 15 XBs and then she's just somehow able to transport away.
Well, I think it's one of those things. She has some sort of device that's like an emergency beam off. You're in a sticky situation. It's preset with certain coordinates. So all you have to do is touch a button and it'll beam you to those coordinates ASAP. So I think that's how she's able to get away in a lot of these. Because otherwise it just wouldn't make sense because someone would have to get a lock on her and then transport her from one place to
the exact moment to transport her, you know?
Yeah. So it's one of those.
So yeah, I mean, that would make sense.
She has to have some sort of device on her that she clicks a button and it'll take her to coordinates. What some specific coordinates and then she could go about her business from there because there's
yeah, just, I mean, that makes sense
because this is like the third time it's happened in this season, so she's got to have something like that.
Yeah she's got it. I mean, I'm sure she does, but yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it with the Borg cube though. I mean, all the Romulans are gone.
Yeah, of this 55 minute episode, I'm thinking maybe you get 5 minutes on the cube, if that.
Yeah, but you still get a lot of, you know, important, I guess.
I mean, you get a lot of information, but it just seems like it's not a lot of time. It's maybe 5-7 minutes on the cube. And then the rest of the stories is back on La Serena with Rios and Picard.
Yeah.
Yeah, that wraps up storyline C. And then to wrap up A and B, back on the ship, you kind of get a conversation with everybody now. Picard, Girardi, Rios, and Soji. They're all sitting on those god-awful picnic tables that we all hate. Or at least we hate.
Yep.
And they're having a conversation.
I think they're universally hated.
Yeah, probably, because they suck. But they're having a conversation where they're pretty much spilling all the beans. So Rios goes into detail about how on the Ibn Majid, they run into two envoys who I can't think of the guy's name. It's something flower. Blossoming flower?
Yeah, it was something like that.
And then Soji's other sister, Janna, they beam aboard. And then, you know, the captain informs Starfleet that they made first contact. And then you kind of get the idea. Well, they explain that what happened was Captain Vandermeer was under orders to destroy them. So he ends up murdering them out of cold blood, and or what Rios thought was cold-blooded murder. And Vandermeer couldn't handle it. He was like, this is wrong. So he kills himself.
Mm-hmm. Right in front of Rios.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And Starfleet orders Rios as acting captain to wipe all records of the situation. Starfleet wipes all records of the Ibn Majid, so you can't even find it in the Starfleet database. And they proceed with this cover-up, all thanks to lovely Commodore O.
Mm-hmm. And also keep in mind, I don't know if this is something that we covered, but Rios, you know, the captain who was supposed to do this, he considered him to be like a father to him. And he would often call him Pops in his head, and you've almost even said it out loud, he even admitted to that. So this guy, Rios, had to watch his captain, who he considered a father, kill himself over what happened in the situation. And that's actually what got him removed from Starfleet, because he pretty much had a mental breakdown after that.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, I don't really blame him.
Yeah. And this is where so after he explains that, this is where you find out that Raffi finally puts everything together, that the Jat Vash was behind the attack on Mars. It was all, you know, a Romulan plan thing so that it would lead the galaxy into banning synths altogether.
Mm-hmm.
You find out O is half Vulcan, half Romulan. That's revealed in this scene.
Finally, that question is answered.
Yes, finally. And then it brought me to a question in my mind. Why didn't the Jat Vash go after Data in TNG when he was created? Why did they wait until after the ban, when Maddox went to his own planet, started researching and creating more human-like androids, to finally do something about it?
Well, the easy answer is the writers didn't think about it until after. The canon answer would probably be because Data was the only sentient android in the universe, and how they explained it was once you reach a certain threshold of synthetic intelligence, then these cybernetic organisms will come, similar to how when a civilization reaches a certain development of warp capability, once they cross that threshold, they are to be accepted amongst the interstellar community. That's the whole idea with First Contact, is that once you reach warp capability as a civilization, then we will proceed with First Contact. It's supposed to be a similar situation to where, you know, these extremely intelligent artificial intelligence would come back once that threshold was met. And Data, although he was a sophisticated piece of technology, he was the only one of his kind, and they had no idea how to recreate that design. Now they have been able to recreate that design, and not only recreate it, they have upgraded to where Soji didn't even know that she was an android. That's how good that they have gotten at this.
Well, yeah, if you think about it, but you know, they say Soji and Daj were built off of single neuron, said super sarcastically, from Data's body. And so if you went after Data early and you were able to dispose of his body, then you cut off the chain of events that would lead to their creation.
True, but he was also a member of the Federation. You know, True. He was also a lieutenant commander with the Federation, and they try to be cautious with that.
But, you know, there's something, we see him either get hacked, or you just see a lot of stuff happen with Data, where, you know, he's obviously vulnerable to some point, and they're obviously smart enough to engineer something like the Mars attack. They should have been smart enough to find a way to, you know, have Data out of the picture without making it look like they were involved. That's all I'm saying.
See, I got a better question for you. This is one that I noticed. Okay, if Janna came on the ship years ago with Rios, on Rios's ship, and she was an android, and she look just like Soji and her sister. But when did Bruce Mannix get on the planet? And are we sure that Bruce Mannix was the one that built her? If this was, you know, this was years ago that this happened. So are we sure that Bruce Mannix was the one that built Soji? You know, are we sure that he was even the one that built any of them? Because now the timeline's starting to come into question. Like, well, does this make sense to where Bruce Mannix went to the planet, built Janna and this other artificial intelligence, sent him on an envoy, but Dr. Girardi had time to bang him like 3 years ago, even though this was years before that even happened? Like, the storylines are starting to conflict.
I think the Girardi happened before the ban. After the ban is when Maddox left. The events that happened on the Ibn Majid with Rios happened like 5 to 7 years ago. I don't know how long he's been out of Starfleet, but it's happened after the ban. And then, so I'm thinking, you know, Maddox created it sometime between 14 and 7 years ago is when he created Jonna, the other sister. That I think that's the timeline we're looking at.
I don't know. It just doesn't feel right.
It's not clear. It's not clear. And that's the thing. So I see your point. You don't know when Dr. Girardi and Maddox were an item. I'm assuming it was pre-ban, so pre before he went off into hiding.
Right.
And then...
Did he go off into hiding like immediately after the ban?
Yes. They pretty much said once the ban took place and the Daystrom Institute was no longer to invest in researching these things, he left. He packed up his shit and was gone.
I guess it's just been a while and I missed that part.
So that's my best idea of the timeline.
Okay.
Two more talking points I think I want to bring up because in this, on La Serena, Soji does take command of the ship and change coordinates to go to, it's pretty much a portal, a Borg type portal to jump to her planet. And I liked how Rios had an override for if someone were to hack into a system or gain control of his ship without his authorization. He had a way to regain control of the ship.
Yeah, that was actually really, that was really smart. I thought that was...
Because at first he's like singing in Spanish and I'm like, what is this? And I was like, I'm listening to it. I don't know a lot of Spanish, but I know enough to know that it seems like some sort of lullaby. And then you see him regain control of the ship and then he explains kind of, he said that was a lullaby his mama used to sing him when he was a boy. And I was like, that's smart. He programmed a safeguard to where he sings that lullaby. He regains control of his ship.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, he's got contingency plans. I like it. It seemed weird at first, but the end result works.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. I thought that was really clever in his part. And what Soji was doing was she was opening up a Borg subspace conduit, which again is another Voyager, which is actually how Voyager got home. Spoilers alert. Was through a Borg subspace conduit. And again, you missed a lot of that when it comes to Voyager. But one of the things that Rios talks about is how, you know, she's not putting up any kind of protective barrier for going through a Borg subspace conduit, which, you know, apparently Rios knows this. I don't know how he knows this, but he does, that if you don't, it would just completely destroy and pretty much vaporize the ship. So she knows about the subspace conduit from her time on the Borg cube, but she wasn't able to pick that up.
Yeah, well, yeah. And it was interesting. It was because when they're sitting at the picnic table and all the information is dumped out, she activates because she was like, I don't know how I know all this stuff now, but I know this, and that. And that's when she takes over the ship. She, like I said, she activates during that conversation, and her memories are flooded with all this information she didn't know that was there.
Right.
And I guess maybe part of it was left out was she needs to put up some sort of shield or something so they don't get destroyed going through that conduit.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last point I wanted to bring up was right before the end scene, the very last scene, you know, Picard and Rios are talking on the bridge and, you know, Picard's just talking about his days as an ensign working the night crew. And I was like, this is a nice side of Picard to see. It's to kind of get an idea of what he was before he kind of went into command when he was still a young ensign, and that he enjoyed the quietness of space and being on the bridge in the middle of the night, or at least we'll say quote unquote night, and having that silence.
Yeah, I mean it's a different side of Picard that we don't normally get to see. That wasn't, I'll admit that was a nice moment.
Yeah, and then the episode ends. They go through the transwarp conduit, and then a cloaked Romulan ship follows them through. So, you know shit's about to happen in episode 9 and 10 because they did mention in this episode, Rizzo mentioned that they dispatched the Romulan fleet to this planet. They were finally able to locate it. So the climax is coming. This, there's a light at the end of this tunnel of Picard, and we're finally going to get to it.
Yeah. I think we talked about that last episode, and I think we were wrong. I think this episode is that the turning point of we're moving on in the story arc. We're past the arc and we're starting to get to the climax. We've gotten to the build up. Everything's built up, yeah. And I think last week we thought it was episode 7 where we're going to see that tipping point. But I think it was this week, after how much information, how much they wrapped up together, they threw into this episode, that this is what they were trying to. This is kind of the turning point of this episode when it comes to the storyline.
Should we punch it?
Punch it, we can beat him.
Punch it,
punch it.
Punch it!
Punch it!
Punch it, hot light!
Punch it, let's get the hell out of here.
Let's punch it.
So, Chris, did you like this episode?
I did. I thought it was a pretty entertaining episode, and I think this episode did a really good job at a lot of little nuanced stuff that old Trekkies and lifelong fans like me noticed. You know, there was a bunch of little stuff that I really enjoyed that we talked about in this episode that you didn't even know really was connected to it. And I think I really do like it when the shows throw in, basically they throw the fans a bone and it's like, oh, look, we're making connections to all the stuff that you paid attention to all these years ago that nobody who's ever actually seen the show really knows what they're talking about. But this is for you guys. And I love it when they do that. I love it when shows try to do it for the fans, especially the diehard committed fans, because those are the ones that keep these shows going. There were some parts of the show that some parts of this episode that I didn't like, but I think the amount of good vastly outweighed the amount of bad. So I'd say that this was a significantly better episode. I think this was probably one of the better episodes so far of the season, if not the best, especially since I did have my favorite scene in it, which is basically the Admiral, you know, just putting Picard in his place, which was... You don't need to do it every episode, just like one time is nice. But what about you?
Yeah, I don't know, and I still don't know. It's been about 24 hours since I've watched the episode. And even when I was trying to type up my notes, I didn't know how I wanted. I couldn't formulate an opinion. I recognize it's a very important episode. It's all pieced together. You finally get to the point where you have all the information. And we're about to hit the climax, but I just didn't like the episode overall.
Really?
Yeah, and like I said, there's some good parts. There's some, you know, like I said, I like the acting in it, especially with Rios and all his different characters. But it just, I don't know, I didn't enjoy it. I don't know, it didn't sit well with me.
Huh? Oh, okay. What do we have in store for next week's episode, Steven?
Next week we will be discussing season 1, episode 9 of Picard, entitled E.T. in Arcadia, part 1. So, part 1 of 2 of the season finale. And the brief description is, following the unconventional and dangerous transit, Picard and crew finally arrive at Soji's homeworld of Capellus. However, Romulan warbirds are on their tail, and their arrival brings greater danger as they uncover more unexpected information from the planet's inhabitants. So, that's what we have in store for next week. That'll do it for this episode of Deep Space High. Thank you everyone for listening. Join us next time as we continue the discussion on Star Trek Picard.
And don't forget to keep the conversation going on Twitter with hashtag Tacos and Trek and hashtag Deep Space High.
And let us know how we're doing by reviewing Deep Space High on Apple Podcasts, wherever you find your podcast. And if you like what you hear, please feel free to subscribe and share our show. I'm Jedi Master Steven.
And I'm Sky Marshal Chris. And until next time, live long and prosper.